Mad Max Fury Road.
Mad Max Fury Road.
We finally saw that. Oh, hi. Didn't see you there.
We finally saw Mad Max Fury Road, which was big for us because, you know, I went to film school and, like, all my professors would always be like, it's the best movie ever. Like, it's a perfect movie. Not maybe the best movie ever made, but it's a perfect movie.
Yeah.
And I just didn't.
So
did you see a bug?
There's a bug out here. We're filming outside because it's beautiful. So you may hear a car go by, but anyway.
And you may see McKay get distracted by bugs.
By a bug. Anyway. What were we talking about?
Mad Max Fury Road.
Mad Max Fury Road is, we watched it with my sister one night for a movie night. And it's absolutely amazing.
It is the perfect movie.
It is the perfect movie.
It's the perfect movie.
It is the perfect movie.
And that is just our opinion, but also it's right. And everybody else is wrong if they don't agree.
Everybody else is wrong if they don't agree.
And we saw Furiosa, too.
We saw Furiosa. Not as
Mad Max Fury Road.
Not as Fury Road.
Still Mad Max Fury Road.
But still, like, so good because, like,
it was Mad Max Fury Road.
I feel like it fleshed out the world in a way that made me appreciate things from Fury Road more.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they did something in Furiosa that I was like, hey, that's from Fury Road, and I understand it more, and it's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And also, Furiosa is just awesome.
It is just awesome. I think there's something to say about movies that are just awesome.
Yeah. That's how I felt about Fury Road, because they were like, I felt like the world was like, it's like a cutthroat, like, post-apocalyptic world, but it's kind of goofy at the same time. And so I feel like they didn't need to, like, spend that much time on the world building, because they know it's kind of crazy and insane and goofy, so they don't need to, like, sell you on it.
Yeah.
You're just kind of like, yeah, his name is Joe, and there is Gas Town. And, you know, they live in this, like, crazy oasis, and I don't know. You just got to see it, man. It's like,
you do,
it's
yeah.
got a tone that I've never seen before in a movie. It's got action that I've never seen.
It's color graded beautifully.
It's color graded amazing. Who knew orange could look so cool?
And blue.
Yeah. Anyway, we're big Mad Maxers right now. And Furiosa was awesome. And.
But that's not what we're talking about.
That's not what we're talking about. I got to mention Animal Well, though.
That is. Okay, all right. This is our. What we're doing right now.
This is our media that we're consuming right now.
We like Mad Max. We've both been playing this game called Animal Well. And it's like a, what's the fancy gamer word?
Metroidvania.
It's Metroidvania, which just means it's one of those cool underground games where you get to solve a lot of puzzles.
Yeah. And it's amazing. It's like there's surprises every turn.
Oh, I love to solve a puzzle.
And it's kind of scary, too.
Yeah. Every time that little kangaroo comes in frame, I'm like, ah!
Sometimes I'll be just, like, doing homework in bed next to Camille, and she'll be playing on the Switch, and she'll be like, oh my gosh, I'm like, what?
And it's just, like, this puzzle game.
And she's way farther than me. You're way farther than
me.
Yeah,
because I'm way, like, way smarter than you. Like, I'm so smart. And you're stupid. I'm kidding.
Well, welcome to Gallery.
You didn't, like, did you agree with that?
That I'm stupid?
Yeah. I think you're smart.
Thanks.
You're welcome. What are you talking about?
I'm not exactly sure how to describe mine under our, like, topic umbrella.
Wait, like, what genre is it? Oh.
He's laying down. Our dog's inside right now. I don't know how to describe it under our topic umbrella because it has to do with video games, but it's not a video game.
Video game art.
Kinda. Well, of course it's art. That's what our podcast
is. Whoa.
Who's the stupid one now?
Me. Ew.
Sorry.
What are you talking about?
You go first.
Why? I literally asked you and you just, like, started getting into it.
No, I want you to go first. I like when you go first. Or maybe we should go first. Wait, maybe I should go first.
Make up your mind.
What are you talking about?
Oh, what?
I'm just asking.
Oh, I'm talking about a movie.
Is it Mad Max Fury Road?
Yes, I'm just kidding. No. Ah.
Okay, I'll go. Let me look over my notes really quick, briefly.
You're like, what was I even talking about?
Because I really forgot.
He's thinking about Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh, the charger came out. Hold on. Okay, sorry.
technology boy, you better print out your notes.
Speaking of technology, I got a question for you.
Yeah?
Would you call technology art?
Like the physical technology?
Yes. Like a device.
I think there's a lot of artistic components to a device.
Okay.
But I'm, you know, I don't know how artful it is to like solder it together.
Hmm. I think I agree with that. I think a device is art, not in the same way like a painting or a film is, but in the same way that like 3D printing is.
Yeah.
Where it's kind of such a cool like and like well devised like technological achievement that it's kind of masterful and artful the way that it was that it came to fruition.
You thinking about that iPad commercial?
I'm talking about the iPad commercial where they crush everything. Did you see that?
Yeah, I did.
Kind of crazy.
I didn't like it.
I didn't like it either.
Well, nobody did, so.
Did you see the clapback that Samsung did?
Yeah.
It's awesome.
If you don't know what we're talking about, don't worry about it.
Yeah. So, that's what I'm talking about today.
The iPad commercial?
No.
Okay.
I think we should crush art into a tiny device.
Okay, the iPad? You talking about the iPad?
No. So I'm talking about, it has
Kindle.
To be video games. No, not a Kindle. Oh, that's a good one, though.
I do love the Kindle.
I am talking about a console, a video game console.
Oh, and the Switch.
No.
The Nintendo Switch.
No.
The Nintendo Switch 2. The Wii U.
No.
Okay, what?
No, you're supposed to be like, what is it? All positively, not mean. Okay, I'm talking about the Game Boy.
The Game Boy?
The Game Boy.
The Game Boy Color?
No.
The Game Boy Advance?
Nope.
The Game Boy Original? I don't know anymore.
The Game Boy. It's just the Game Boy.
Oh.
The Nintendo Game Boy that was released in 1989.
89?
Yeah.
Jeez.
So, history lesson.
I love this
part.
We
just scared a duck with my laugh. There's a little creek down there. So, it's a handheld video game console from 1989. And so, it wasn't Nintendo's first handheld console because they had done, you know, Mr. Game & Watch from Smash Bros.? He's actually
from... Love that guy.
Yeah. He's actually from... You do not love him. You just love that he can do the nine hammer. Anyway. So one day, some Nintendo employee... This is foggy. I didn't do research on this part, but it's just something I know. A Nintendo employee was commuting on the train one day in Japan to work, and he saw a bored businessman on the train playing with a calculator.
Ew.
You don't
want
to do that. What are you, a nerd?
Get a calculator watch like everybody else.
it was like the early 80s.
Dude, is that what they were doing in the 80s for you to play with calculators? They got their TI-84.
Well, that's exactly what this employee was looking at. So he was like, I bet I could make a game out of that. And so he did. He made these little, like one-game-only handhelds called Game & Watches that were a watch. They could tell the time, but they also had little games on them that were made with those little like the same kind of technology that calculator screens use. Did you ever, like, have those little Sonic handheld games from McDonald's that they included with Happy Meals?
Yeah.
That's the same technology as a Game & Watch.
Weird.
Yeah. So that was kind of Nintendo's first or one of their first forays into the handheld gaming space.
Foray.
Yeah.
Big word, McKay.
No. And so after the success of the NES in the 80s, they wanted to kind of do another handheld. And so they were bouncing around with some ideas, and one of the ideas was a portable NES with interchangeable cartridges. Because I think that what they were originally planning was to just do, like, more Game & Watches. And the thing about Game & Watches is they were just, like, it was one game per console. Like, if you wanted a different game, you had to buy another little handheld. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much they were, but... So Nintendo wanted to be like, well, what if we gave you... This sounds a lot like the Switch, so I'll talk about this later, but... They wanted to give you the home console gaming experience on the go. And they were bouncing around on how to... They're bouncing around ideas on how to do this, and one person said, well, let's make the cartridges interchangeable too, which was a tough task back then with the technology they had. So originally it was supposed to have a much brighter LCD screen. It was supposed to be much more powerful, but it actually ended up being neither of those. They ended up kind of cutting back on certain things to make it way more affordable to produce and way more affordable for, like, families and like, kids to buy. And so they ended up going with a really tiny screen, and they did end up going with the interchangeable cartridges, but the screen didn't have a backlight on it. So you had to have a separate light source. You had to play it outside or under a lamp to see what was on screen, which, you know, kind of sounds awful. And the console was like, it was pretty big. It was like a brick.
Dang.
It was pretty massive. It was like the size of our mixer, but it was a big, chunky console. And you might look at that today and be like, this is so stupid. Like, this must have been the worst console ever.
Everybody loved it. I'm just guessing.
Okay, well, yeah. Everybody loved it, even though it was way technologically inferior to not only the NES, but, like, a bunch of the other hand. There were already handhelds on the market that were way more powerful.
So they weren't the first ones.
No, they weren't. They weren't necessarily the first ones, because Sega was doing stuff too.
Did they have interchangeable cartridges?
Yeah, the Game Gear. Sega had, I don't know if the Game Gear was, I think the Game Gear was after the Game Boy, but anyway, it was not technologically superior is the point that I'm trying to make.
Weird.
Yeah.
And everyone loved it because.
So that's what I'm trying to get to. Everyone loved it because of the games that it had, and because of how affordable it was. It was way cheaper than everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it wasn't as technologically superior, people still wanted it because you could get it quicker. And it was Nintendo. They had Mario on there, you know? They had Zelda. And so, as of 2024, the original Game Boy, the green screen, you know, two AA battery brick Game Boy, is the fourth best-selling console of all time.
Sheesh.
The fourth best-selling console of all time.
What are the top three?
I believe the top three are the Switch, the PS2, and the Wii.
Whoa.
Yeah, right?
Nintendo.
Not in that order. I think the PS2 is still on top. But, yeah, that's a lot of Game Boys.
Get them, Nintendo.
Yeah, right? So they were on top with this back in the early 90s. So the reason why I'm bringing it on our art podcast is because of the philosophy in which they made it. Because you're thinking, it doesn't make sense to make something technologically inferior, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the coined phrase that they had during this time, and the thing that drives Nintendo back then and even today, is lateral thinking with withered technology. So the Game Boy isn't art because it's, or the Game Boy is art because it's the result of talented people focusing their efforts to balance economic and technological efficiency with fun and innovation. So they're taking this inferior technology and they're saying, how can we not only make a profit, but really use this old technology and push it to its limits? You know, what can we do with something old? What can we do with something outdated? And what they did was a global phenomenon. You know, what they were able to accomplish with the Game Boy was amazing.
Which, I mean, I still feel like they're doing the same thing.
They're doing
the Switch isn't very graphically inclined. Mm-mm. Like, the other consoles that are on the market right now are, like, huge and crazy. Yeah, it's all about graphics. Stuff. And so Nintendo could technically be behind, but obviously the Switch is, like, you know.
The Switch is super underpowered, and the Switch 2 is still going to be underpowered.
But it's still going to sell more than PS5.
Yes, because it has games, and they're focused on pushing the envelope with what they have rather than just focusing all their efforts on, like, Game Pass or graphics, you know? The Switch might be, you know, less technically inferior, but it has, like, Breath of the Wild. It has Mario Odyssey. It has, like, some of these genre-defining games that everybody loves. And I don't mean to say that, like, the PlayStation or Xbox doesn't have meaningful games, but they definitely don't have the same philosophies that Nintendo does. And I think that's what really puts Nintendo apart from them. You know, they, you know, each of the big three, Xbox, PlayStation, Nintendo, they all have their flaws. But they all have their advantages, too. And Nintendo's the one that fascinates me the most. And it's the one that I think makes their games art. And it's what makes them one of the most, like, lateral thinkers in the industry today and back in the 90s, and the Game Boy's proof.
So you're bringing up this really weird and nostalgic feeling for me that I remember feeling this way when the iPods started to come out.
Yeah, like the iPod Touches or the...
Before the iPod Touches.
The ones where you had to scroll on the wheel. Oh, yeah. Man.
And I remember getting an iPod with, like, a screen on it.
Yeah.
And, you know, my family didn't have a screen. And then I remember my sister getting, like, an iPod Nano, which was, like, a little touchscreen. And it was crazy.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, my iPod sucks. Wish I had an iPod Nano, you know?
Yeah, right.
And then, like, right after that, a better iPod came out, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember this feeling. I must have been, like, what, a freaking middle schooler? And I remember being like, this is weird, because I feel like I just got the next best technology, and it will never be the next best technology. Mm-hmm. Even though I have it in my hands, it's always going to be getting better. There's always going to be something new that I'm going to want. It's never good enough.
Yeah.
And I, like, you know, I'm thinking back to, like, the 80s when, like, stuff like this was coming out, and how great it was to have a freaking phone. And, like, now iPhone is coming out every single, like, year with a new iPhone that is slightly different, but it's, like, the most technologically advanced thing out there. And I remember kind of getting, like, frustrated with this feeling of, I wish it could be enough. And so I'm relating this because that's kind of what Nintendo feels like to me. They're taking the technology and they're making it enough.
That's exactly the point I'm trying to make.
Cool.
Yeah. And that's a principle of art, in my opinion. You know, we talked about this with Eliza Ivanova. Less is more.
Yeah.
And Nintendo understood this. And they understood that it's a proper gaming experience that people really care about. And that people like kind of should care about.
Yeah. And is it not artful to use your materials to make something that people love?
Exactly. Exactly. So in that way, I think technology, and the Game Boy especially, is art. Cool. It's just a fascinating piece of technology.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about the games a little bit.
Okay.
Because the Game Boy itself was not the only thing it had going for it. So, I want to read the sentence I wrote down because I think it's going to sum up what we're talking about. It's not innovative because it does anything new. It's innovative because it did what it aimed to do well.
Ooh.
It gave us, and so it gave us so many, like, pillars of global media.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Wait, can I jump in?
Yeah.
You know what this reminds me of?
What's up?
Pandora. Or Avatar Way of Water. Whatever it is.
The movie?
Mm-hmm.
Like the first Avatar?
No, the second one.
Why?
Both of them. Because I feel like...
What the frick?
Listen, you haven't seen either Avatars?
No.
Okay, listen. That's the thing. Everyone's like, all of the film bros are like, oh my gosh, you've never seen Avatar Way of Water. It's like the most CGI intensive, like,
what you just did to
furthest
me.
It's the furthest advanced technological filmmaking in all of history and everything like that. Like, yeah. They're like, it's the pushing the boundaries. It was $1 billion.
Yeah.
And like, people were like, yeah, it was pretty good.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's what I feel like that is. It's like there's so many films, like I think of the first one that comes to head, like Napoleon Dynamite, that did not cost
a
lot of money.
Totally.
And it didn't use the most technologically advanced, like, there, I don't know how much CGI is in Napoleon Dynamite, but everybody loves it because it did what it needed to do. It did what it was trying to do.
Yeah. And we were talking about this with, like, Animal Well.
Yeah.
You have the most biggest blown budget games, like God of War Ragnarok and, like, Spider-Man 2 that are, like, $500
million. Which, by the way,
do
what their name... They
liked God of War Ragnarok. I didn't play Spider-Man 2 because you'd have to, like...
Hater.
Waterboard
You're
me
hating.
To me to buy a PS2.
You're a hater.
Or a PS5. Okay, anyway. The point... The PS5 is fine.
Okay,
that's
continue.
A discussion for another
get
day.
Get to the point.
Sorry, I got
He's thinking about the PS5. He's
I'm
tweaking.
Angry. You know, you have these games with super big budgets, and then you have Animal Well, which just came out and is getting glowing reviews more than like some of the other AAA games right now. It was made by one guy, and it's smaller than like a picture, like some high res pictures, honestly.
Yeah.
Which is awesome, which is amazing.
Smaller being like the gigabytes that it takes
up. The file size, yeah.
Not how big it is.
Because it is big. It is a dense game. And so like quality over quantity, honestly, is the name of the game here.
Yeah.
So, and that's a good transition because that's how the games were for the Game Boy. The first one, you cannot mention the Game Boy without mentioning Pokemon.
Oh.
Pokemon is where the Game Boy is where Pokemon got its start. And it... blew up. RPGs, role-playing games, where you kind of walk around these maps and you do these turn-based fights. Kind of like, you know, Baldur's Gate is a good example, Pokemon is a good example, Final Fantasy. Back then, they combined this with the idea of capturing monsters. So rather than kill the enemies that you fight, you capture them with Pokeballs and then you use them to fight. And that was super endearing. They dropped two versions of the same game on Game Boy, and it blew up. Pokemania was crazy. That's what it was called back then. And the way that it's affected media and the way that it's grown today is amazing.
Isn't it like the number one franchise?
I was just about to say that. It is the number one highest grossing media franchise. More than Star Wars, more than Harry Potter.
Sheesh.
Pokemon is number one. Now, there's a lot you can say about modern Pokemon. But back in the day, Pokemon was like the thing. You had, everybody had their Pokemon that they picked. You know, everybody was, you know, doing battles. They actually introduced a cable that you could plug into one person's GameCube and another person's Game Boy and another person's Game Boy, and you could battle with a cable.
Aww.
Isn't that cute?
That's cute.
I know. And so that's another example of lateral thinking with withered technology. They're saying, okay, what kind of accessories can we add to make this, you know, the best kind of experience?
Like the Wii Nunchuck.
Exactly. What?
I loved the Wii Nunchuck.
All right. The other game that you can't not mention without mentioning the Game Boy is Tetris.
Yeah.
I can't remember if Tetris debuted. I can't remember if it debuted on the Game Boy and then came out on the NES later. I think it did.
They made a movie about
it. They made a movie with Taron Egerton about it. And I liked it.
It was pretty good.
It was good. But Tetris was like, Tetris is like a technical and cultural masterpiece. It's like, it's so irrevocable. They call it the perfect game for a reason. Not because it's like, it is a 10 out of 10 masterpiece in my opinion. But like, not because it's like the most insane graphics and like the story is amazing. But it's just got the tightest, most addictive, most straightforward, no fat gameplay.
There's also like, they named like, what's that called? The behavioral thing where you start to see Tetris shapes in the world around you because you play Tetris so much.
I have that.
That's happened to me. We had a phase where we played Tetris all the time.
Yeah. Oh,
and
yeah,
I would be like, that looks like it could fit together.
Yeah, right. And there's a reason that like when anybody's packing a car, they always make the joke like, all right, time for Tetris.
Or the dishwasher.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Very culturally significant.
So culturally significant. As culturally significant as like some pieces of classical music, some films.
Yeah.
Tetris is up there as a landmark piece of media in like culture.
That's why they made that OK movie about it.
With Taron Egerton. And it was about him and not the guy that made Tetris. But we'll talk about that.
It's action-packed.
Action-packed. Russia. Rah! So it was from the Game Boy.
Yeah.
The Game Boy didn't need the most insane graphically...
Blocks.
It just needed blocks. And because everybody played Tetris. You know? And now it's so popular. I think Tetris for a while was the number one best-selling game of all time. But it got dethroned recently.
By
Minecraft, which I'm okay with because I love Minecraft.
That's cool. Another game made by an indie developer by himself.
True, and now it's owned by freaking Microsoft. Anyway, this is gonna turn into McKay's gaming.
Yeah, you're like a big hater.
Anyway, Zelda Link's Awakening is on there. You know, yep. They brought Zelda to the handheld and Super Mario Land 1 and 2. These big console gaming experiences on a handheld. It was just such a big deal.
Yeah.
So that's really all I have to say. I think the Game Boy is a technological, artful landmark, and I think the principles behind it being made are also the principles that are driving some of the most impressive art these days. Less is more, lateral thinking with withered technology, or lateral thinking with withered supplies, or lateral thinking with age-old, like, principles.
That's really cool.
And the Game Boy does that. And I think it's art because of that.
I wouldn't have thought that you'd brought a console to the podcast. Yeah. I thought you were going to talk about the Game Boy games mostly, but it's interesting that you focused on the console itself because of its creation.
Mm-hmm. It takes creativity to use things in interesting ways, including processors and screens and buttons and technology.
And I think that even speaks to just... that beginning statement that you made about that guy who saw someone playing with a calculator and was like, I could do something about that.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I feel like that's sometimes where the best ideas come from is when you're just in your normal day-to-day life and you get a creative person who is like, I have an idea.
That's how Tetris was made.
Yeah.
It was just, Tetris was, I think Alexey Pajitnov, I think his Tetris was just like something he was making in his free time on his like home computer. Crazy.
King. I mean, that's what Stardew Valley was.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Really cool.
Thank you.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? A movie? What movie?
A movie.
Give me hints so I can guess.
You will not guess it.
Really? Yeah. Is it a, like an old one?
It's from 1967.
Oh, is it?
You don't know a single movie from 1967.
Yeah, I do.
Name one without Googling it. I'm talking about, okay, I'll give you some hints.
Okay.
It is described as an American biographical neo-noir crime film.
Scarface.
That's like from the 30s. Okay, you're not going to guess.
Give me more hints. I want to just try.
It's directed by Arthur Penn. And it stars Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway.
What's the first letter of the title?
B.
The, no. Big.
Bonnie and Clyde.
Oh, really?
Bonnie and Clyde.
No way.
Yeah.
I could have guessed that if you.
Do you know anything about this movie?
I know that Bonnie and Clyde versus Romeo and Juliet is one of the epic rap battles of history. I love it.
Okay. So, I'm going to do kind of a history lesson with mine, too. Because okay. Mine has to do with a lot of the history of the film studios.
Sure.
So, something to know. I'm going to go over, like, a basic film history.
Okay.
Hollywood is kind of split into two eras. The studio era and, like, the new Hollywood era. And so, old Hollywood was totally dominated by, like, five studios. Paramount,
MGM,
RKO, the other ones. Wait, I wrote them down.
That reminds me of Inside when Bo Burnham's like, income inequality, racial strife, the other stuff.
Yeah. 20th Century Fox and Warner Brothers.
Ah.
And so during the studio era, all of the studios were in charge of everything. The rules were very, very strict, and they had very, very strict codes that they followed.
Okay.
And these codes are like comparable to the rating system that we use today, like PG, PG-13, and stuff.
Okay.
And so these codes.
So they're like codes of like content rather than how they're filmed.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And so this, I'm not going to go a lot into that. There's so much to say, obviously. Sure. You can get a degree in it.
Yeah.
But
Someone did. She's really cute. Sorry.
Ugh.
Sorry I did that.
Yeah. I'm just kidding. So I wanted to talk about kind of this shift to new Hollywood, because Bonnie and Clyde is one of the like main films that shifts to new Hollywood.
Describe new Hollywood.
So,
is it kind of how it is now?
This new Hollywood is right after the decline of the codes.
Okay.
And so the codes are like, let's see. They were pretty intense. They were based on a very Catholic value set.
Okay.
And so they said no more than 3 seconds of continuous kissing on screen.
Wow.
All criminal action had to be punished, and no sympathy could be garnered from audiences.
Oh, so they're even doing like story stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Clergy couldn't be portrayed as villainous or comedic characters.
Holy crap. Could you imagine if we had these rules now?
Yeah. They were super, wow, super intense. And if you know, you had these things in your movie, it would be rejected from the first, like you wouldn't even get filmed and stuff.
Wow.
And so these studios were super in charge of it, because like in the end, what film wanted to be at that time was a family thing. They wanted families to go to the movie theaters, and if it had kissing in it, then they didn't want their kids to see that.
Families don't kiss.
Yeah.
Frick you.
Not in the 30s. They were too depressed.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
And so
this was in the 60s. Oh,
and then this obviously started to just kind of decline and wither away, in part because Europe was making a lot of like art house films that didn't have these codes like the Americans did.
Like Germany.
And they
and
had
stuff.
Kissing and full frontal nudity, you know, in their films. And they were coming over to the States, and people were like, yeah, that's pretty good. And and
full
so that
nudity.
Was changing like things.
Sign me up.
Yeah. And of course, the war changed a lot of things, yeah. Especially particular like violence in film.
Yeah.
Because it was real,
yeah,
then. And that's also during an era in Europe when a lot of people, like the French New Wave,
yeah, that
movement,
yeah,
they were saying, like, we don't really want studio films. We want, like, in the streets. We want to know what's happening. We want real people, real actors.
Yeah.
And so that's what was all about. It was all leaking over to America.
Yeah.
And so that's around the time where they also said studios can't own theaters. That's not fair. And they own everything. It's like a monopoly.
Wow.
So everything was just falling apart. It ended with the Paramount case, which kind of ended the codes.
Sure.
And then this all kind of culminated in them being like, oh, what do we do now? Oh, by the way, TV.
What about it?
TV was on the advent, like it was on the rise, and that was ruining film for a lot
of people. Were people kind of saying, like, kind of how, like, they were like, photography's going to ruin painting.
Yeah, they said TV's going to ruin movies.
Wow.
Because TV's accessible, it's in your home, you don't have to go to a stinky theater, it doesn't have AC, you know? And so, with all of this happening, film was just on the down low.
Sure.
People weren't going to theaters anymore.
Yeah.
And so they said, in order to survive, we need to do what the kids want.
The kids.
The youths, because they you know, pulled their markets and they realized that only like 30 and under were going to the movies. And so they were like, well, we need to have directors who are 30 and under, you know,
wow.
who are young, and they'll give the people what they want, and they'll do a little bit of European art house in the middle of it and stuff. And so this is also when they started giving directors more freedom of control in filmmaking.
Cool.
And so the main shift is that studios were in charge in old Hollywood, and then the directors were in charge in new Hollywood.
Okay.
And new Hollywood comes with the directors like Woody Allen, Steven Spielberg.
Whoa.
Like Spielberg. George Lucas.
Oh, wow.
Martin Scorsese.
The big ones.
The big ones. And they were allowed to be big because they were in charge.
Right.
And so their names are the famous ones instead of 20th Century Fox being the famous ones.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, you look at people like Charlie Chaplin, who were totally, strictly controlled by the studios.
Yeah.
And he wasn't so famous as the studios were so famous.
Yeah.
He later rose to fame, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know, you don't know a lot of names from the 20s and 30s of cinema because the names didn't matter.
Yeah.
The studios did.
So let's do a little summary of what you just said.
Yeah.
Back in the 20s and 30s, film was really controlled by the main studios, and this brought a lot of trouble with getting the movies out to the right people.
They were going to the right people, but the directors were really frustrated.
Okay, and then the rise of TV is starting to happen, mm-hmm. and then
the decline of film
and World War II.
And then this is also when, like, it's very interesting to see film kind of fight for the struggle for people to come back to theaters, which is kind of what they're doing now.
Even though I think it's been better.
And so they started, like, implementing more color.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
TVs didn't have color. They had stereo surround systems. They even implemented 3D in this era.
Dang.
That's when it was invented, to try and get people to come back to the cinema.
So World War II and a lot of other factors.
Foreign film.
And TV is causing a decline in movies around this time. And they need a change.
Okay. And that is where we get Bonnie and Clyde. So this comes out in 1967. And obviously Bonnie and Clyde was like really popular at the time.
Yeah.
Just the people.
Yeah.
Just this crime couple going off on their spree, and all of the good American housewives were like, oh, I can't believe she would do that. You know? And so they kind of captured the heart of, like, the American people, right? Mm-hmm. And so they put out this film that was directed by Arthur Penn, and it's only 5% accurate to the real Bonnie and Clyde.
Those 5% being their names.
Yeah, literally.
Probably.
And, like, a picture they took.
Yeah.
And so it really is, I'm not going to go into the plot as much, but it really is just Bonnie is bored. She's a waitress. She sees Clyde steal her mom's car. And instead of going and getting him in trouble, she's like, please take me with you.
Yeah.
And so they kind of start their crime duo thing. They go off and they rob a couple places, and they're like, we could do bigger. And they start robbing banks. They get a bigger gang and posse with them.
Yeah.
It gets more intense. They start killing people.
Shoot.
You know, in their robberies, they like capture a cop.
Yeah.
And it just ends really, really poorly. And in the end, they are shot to death in their car.
Right.
And so we know that that happened actually to the real Bonnie and Clyde. But
there's the other 3% of the accuracy.
Yeah. But what makes this so different is that it was made, first of all, with kind of this choppiness and like emotional variety of like European art house films.
Interesting. Like editing wise?
Yes, but also like emotional wise and stuff. And so this movie is really funny. It's also really scary.
Dang.
It's also really crime-esque. It's also really kind of cute and sexy, you know, because they're the prettiest people you've ever seen in your life.
Kind of sounds like a modern action film.
Yeah,
a little bit.
It is.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because so much of today's film take stuff from Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah.
Because it was kind of the advent of this thriller.
Yeah.
And so the ending actually became known as one of the bloodiest death scenes in cinematic history.
Wow.
Which obviously is not true today. But when they saw it then, they were like, oh my gosh. Which is in part because this is also a period in film where they just figured out how to make blood splurts.
Oh.
Like with the blood under your clothing.
Yeah.
And so it would like set off a little charge and like blood would come out.
Yeah.
Where most film before that had depicted death as painless and bloodless.
Mm.
This was really really bloody.
Was that part of some of the content restrictions that the studios had?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. It totally went against the codes. But at this point, the codes are gone.
Got it.
And so it's actually really interesting because the Warner Brothers, which was the studio that they were under, they were really reluctant to put out this film because they saw it and they were like, oh, my gosh.
Holy frick.
That's kind of crazy. And so they didn't market it at all.
Wow.
And so it still got a release and the critics were all like, this is the worst crap I've ever seen. It has the worst, like, it's super violent. It romanticizes, like, these villainous couples.
Doesn't square with the values that are going on in culture.
Exactly. And then the people got to it, and they were like, this is awesome. And because
I'm sorry, who said that it was bad? The directors?
Critics.
Oh, critics.
Right. And Warner Brothers. And so the people got it. They loved it. The reviews were really good.
Wow.
And this led to the director being like, I'm going to sue you if you don't give this a general release. And so Warner Brothers had to give it a general release. They released it in their theaters. And then critics saw like such a positive response from audiences. And some critics went and saw it again. They gave a completely different review.
Interesting.
And they were like, oh, it's really good now.
Interesting.
I know. Which is just really funny. And so they say it's funny, it's brutal, it's beautiful, it's a whirlwind of passion, devastation, and everything in between. It looks like a French New Wave film because it's so, like, real and raw and stuff. Yeah. And the problem is that it just became really controversial from that point on.
Bonnie
and
Clyde.
So, so many people, like, there were rallies against it, and, like, you know, people were like, how dare you put this in our cinemas? It has sexual undertones. It romanticizes young people ruining their lives.
Yeah.
But the other reviews are saying that it, like, is amazing, and this is real, and we should be showing stuff like this. And so one reason I wanted to bring it up is that this film in particular is criticized as being the one to open the floodgates to heightened violence in cinema.
Wow.
And so, I mean,
interesting.
Look around. Like, there's a lot of violence in cinema.
Like in Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah, literally.
You know, like crazy violence.
Literally. And so something I wanted to talk about was that, like, where does violence fit in artistic merit?
Wow, okay.
Because there's, you know, even today, there's a lot of controversial stuff with Bonnie and Clyde. They say that wasn't necessary, particularly for the time.
Yeah.
But there's also people who say that it was beautiful.
Yeah. I think of Mortal Kombat. When Mortal Kombat first came out, you know, the gore was a huge controversy.
Yeah.
That's an interesting question because, you know, whenever you talk about film, I always think of, like, I always square it with what's going on today. And, you know, I think that, like, that's always going to be a topic when you talk about art is, oh, that's like, is it too violent? Is it, you know, is it too, like, is there too much, like, bad stuff in it? And obviously, like, I think that everybody's different. For me, there's a line. For you, there's a line of, like, the stuff that, like, we're comfortable with and stuff. But I think that, like, there's value in kind of showing, like, hard to digest things like violence and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's value in showing things that are very real rather than totally perfect and, like, squeaky clean and stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the context of Bonnie and Clyde, I remember seeing it and, loving it.
Yeah.
I loved this movie. And I was like, wow, this is so tame. Like, it's one of those thrillers that isn't, yeah, like, super crazy violent and stuff. And then I realized it had an R rating, and it had all this controversial stuff with it. And I kind of remember being surprised, because I was like, oh, I've seen a lot worse.
Yeah.
And for me, the reason why I think Bonnie and Clyde's violence is okay is because the film was done in such a way where it kind of rubs your nose in the violence. It wants you to be a little bit uncomfortable by it.
That's kind of what I was trying to say earlier. It's like I think it's important to like make you a little uncomfortable and be like, oh, that's a lot more authentic kind of. Yeah.
And with all of the emotional like variety in this film, it has a lot of times where you're laughing with Bonnie and Clyde and you're rooting for Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah.
You become very close with them. And, you know, this is something that films weren't doing before.
Yeah.
And so suddenly you're rooting for this villainous people. Then you start seeing them make serious mistakes, like killing people and getting into trouble and like bringing down other people with them.
Yeah.
And suddenly you're like, you're the butt of the joke
now
because you were laughing with them. You were their friend. And now, like, what are you? You're still laughing with them?
Yeah.
And so it kind of gives the audience this moment of, oh, maybe I should rethink.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that's powerful. I think films should do that.
Yeah, totally.
And the line for me is when films are like, funny violence.
We talked about this when we were talking about Mad Max versus Furiosa.
Yeah.
Because we feel like, let me preface this by saying, I think of a lot of paintings where there's gore in the paintings, there's a bit of violence, but the violence and the gore is important to the story of the painting. I think of like The Death of Marat.
Oh, yeah, geez. That's a big one.
And like,
Bathtub Death.
Bathtub Death. I think of the, I forget the name of the painting, but it's the guy in the white shirt with the arms are up with the firing squad.
Oh.
Who's that by?
I don't remember.
Goya. It's by Goya, I think. Yeah.
Francisco Goya. Well, speaking of Francisco Goya. Like the Chronos eating his son.
Yeah.
That is an insane painting.
And like even paintings of the crucifixion of Christ.
Yeah.
It feels weird to say, but like the gore is important to the story and the feeling that is trying to be portrayed. And so what we were talking about with Mad Max and Furiosa is the violence in Mad Max feels like it's world building.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like you're meant to be like, oh shoot, rather than gross you out and make you feel gross.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought that some of the violence in Furiosa was a bit gratuitous.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a line to where it's like, okay, this is a bit much and stupid, like Cocaine Bear. And then there are things like Mad Max Fury Road, or even like the Fallout show, where it's like, okay, this is important.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's different, but you know.
Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of the thing to consider. Everybody has different lines. My personal opinion is that there's violence in life. And if you are to only watch films that are Disney and happy. I mean, even Disney has some violence in it, right?
I would say Disney has some of the worst violence ever.
The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Hunchback of Notre Dame. Everyone's like, Disney is for kids. Really? Because because a church official, okay, motorcycle guy. Because a church official murders the mother of a deformed child and burns down the house of an innocent family.
All Disney, for that gypsy girl. And so,
I get what you're saying, though.
I'm saying that, like, I know a lot of people who prefer not to watch rated R cinema, which is totally okay. Like,
absolutely okay.
Do what you gotta do. But I know a lot of people who won't watch it because of the rating.
Just the rating.
Like, none of the content was considered. None of, like, the plot. None of, like, what the actual violence is or whatever has made it rated R. And
this is important because I feel like some of the most important films with some of the most, like, with some of the deepest, most meaningful messages have R ratings because of something stupid that could have been taken out. Like, I think of The Holdovers. I think of Eighth Grade. Society of the Snow is a little different because it's just rated R because they like are so genuine with it, but like there's a lot more to a film than its rating.
Mm-hmm. And I think that comes across in the codes. They were just like made up, you know, in the 30s.
Yeah.
And when they went away, it was replaced with the MPAA rating, right? And even then, it's been, like, heavily changed. They only had a G, an M, and an X rating.
Yeah.
At that point, like, M being, like, mature, if you're 16, you had to have a parent, and X being, like, 16 and under aren't allowed. And slowly that was changed, and the X rating became, like, a porn thing, and so they totally got rid of that because people would like make it double X's and stuff. Totally. To me, that's really crazy.
Yeah.
And so they got rid of that. They got the R rating. They got the PG rating because some people were like, this isn't good enough for all general audiences. Then they got PG-13.
Yeah.
Like, it just keeps changing. And so I really feel like you need to just learn what your line is and make sure that you don't cross it. Don't make yourself uncomfortable, but don't shield yourself from valuable cinema. I just like my discussion point, violence in cinema. For me, it has a place.
Totally.
And sometimes I think it's very important. And in the context of Bonnie and Clyde, I think it was very important.
Yeah.
And I loved that movie.
Yeah.
But some people might not.
And that's okay.
And that's okay.
So,
regardless of if Bonnie and Clyde opened the floodgates to violence in cinema, it's not something that you're ever going to be able to completely avoid. It's in all sorts of movies, and it's in everything around us, really. Yeah. And so, KK had something to say.
Yeah.
So, what I think my ending statement is that I'm grateful that I can make my own decisions.
Yeah.
And I don't think that it should ever be a place of judgment where you judge people for not choosing to watch certain films or choosing to watch certain films.
Totally. Totally. And I'm going to say that, like, you know, art is different things to so many different people, and everyone's different. But don't bar yourself from an amazing experience because of one factor. And I'm not even talking about like ratings or like violence anymore. You know, try not to judge a book too much by its cover, and really explore what you can, and come to your own conclusions when you can.
And since we're just saying our opinions now, consume media that you're not used to. Go watch a film from the 60s. The Technicolor in Bonnie and Clyde is truly one of the most beautiful things I've ever laid my eyes on. That movie is a dream to look at.
Absolutely.
Not only because Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway are like gorgeous, but because like just the like coloring of that century or of that like decade even was beautiful.
Yeah.
And it was fun to watch. I loved it. It was funny. It was interesting.
Yeah.
And it's from the 60s. And I feel like that's not, you know, a lot of people don't go, hey, what movies from 67 do you want to watch today?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So get out of your bubble a little.
Get out of your bubble. Watch animated movies. Play video games. Go to art museums.
There's so much out there than just Netflix.
If you have never seen it and you say, I don't think I'll like it, that's your sign to watch it. Honestly, that's your sign to explore it and really see if you don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
You never know what you will discover if you give it a shot.
There's been a lot of art that I've seen, particularly movies for me, just because I've seen a lot of random movies that have completely changed like my brain chemistry and the way that I think about the world. And
absolutely,
I am so grateful for that. I'm grateful for the perspective, and being able to walk a 2-hour mile in other people's shoes is invaluable.
Yeah, and art allows us to do that.
Soapbox done.
Soapbox done.
Ended.
Go play Game Boy and go watch Bonnie and Clyde. Go watch
old movie.
Yeah.
But if you don't like violence, maybe don't watch that.
You could play Tetris. There's really no violence in Tetris.
It's not that bad. It's from the 60s. Like, it's not going to be that bad.
Yeah. There's no violence in Tetris.
Play Tetris.
Play Tetris.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.